And long, awkward silence, right, Madeline?
Yeah.
And we go for that.
And then we go, okay, that's okay.
You just totally ruined a poor child's dreams of coming here for chocolate sugar. So we're on to, I think, three weeks in a row?
3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. So, but it's going to be a thing. And we're going to wait until they actually say something.
Wow.
Or maybe they'll start making the chocolate sugar.
Oh, what? Well, yeah, it's one or the other. Right? It's one or the other. So yesterday, let's go around the room. Everybody introduce themselves, starting right here.
Sure. Hi, Lewis Wheeler, and I play Atticus in the play.
Aaron Dowdy, and I play Tom Robinson.
Nate Oakes, and I play Jem.
Heidi Dowling, Gloucester Stage.
Charles Singleton, I play Calpurnia.
Pat Del Piez, good morning, Gloucester. We're glad to see you guys back.
Jem Del Piez, I drove her here.
Good morning, Gloucester. Kim.
And the Zucchis. Go ahead.
Madeline Chimitaro. Mm-hmm.
Famous daughter.
Daughter, yeah.
And? Go ahead. Oh, Eloise. Go ahead. And my daughter Eloise is here, who has asked me for 3 weeks in a row to actually be on the podcast, and now all of a sudden, good stage.
I didn't say me. I said other people.
Okay. She wants to be the producer. That's
Well, she's very creative.
She would be terrible. In that
she's
place.
Very creative. Anyway, okay. So we went yesterday, didn't we? Oh, God, this is a podcast. It can't be a shaking her head. Madeline, you could be the spokesperson. What were your thoughts about going to the play beforehand and after we saw it? What were your thoughts?
I was excited to see it, although I didn't know the story at all.
It was your mom.
Holocaust.
You also said
it. That was you. That was you.
Come on. So it was your mom's favorite story. You told us, right?
Uh-huh.
Favorite book.
Mm-hmm.
And
after I saw it, it was very deep, and I liked it a lot.
There you go. Yeah, we all liked it a lot. It was, for me to explain how much I like this, I'm afraid I'm gonna offend people.
No, just go ahead.
Just let it rip. All right, I'm gonna let it rip. So I've been to a bunch of plays at Gloucester Stage, and because of my work schedule, I'm usually really tired. I like to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm always really tired. So I've gone to a bunch of the plays, and I've fallen asleep in a lot of the plays, only because I just am exhausted. But this play was 2.5 or 2 hours and 15 minutes long.
Yes.
And luckily for me, I said this earlier, saying I'm so lucky that I have such a terrible memory because I didn't remember the book from when I read it in high school, but we were on the edge of our seats from the start to the finish, and Kim cried last week when she got into trying to explain the story. She really genuinely was crying during the podcast. It was so intriguing to me that I'm like, I have to go to this play. Brought the girls, and I have to say, I had high expectations because of what Kim had told me.
I was worried about that, like, like you might, you know.
I was too. To be honest with you, I was too. Like, you have a tendency, as you know, you have a different. You know, your world views and your sensitivity, you're much more sensitive than I am, you know. And I was like, oh, she's saying this, but am I going to go? Am I going to fall asleep again? But I took the shot, you know, because I was, you know, I got the girls, and this is a great story to bring the girls to. So we went, and I have to say, like, so I had these high expectations. They blew them out of the water, and it was on so many different levels. Like, so the cast is okay. First of all, there's accents here, but we talk about this. Like, we can't stand watching a lot of Boston movies because they butcher the accents, and we just can't. You know, it's like you can't get past that.
Right, but let's throw in Spotlight. Did not do that, and Lewis was in.
He was not in Spotlight.
Actually, I was not in Spotlight. I was in Black Mass.
Black Mass.
Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah. Black Mass did a good job with that.
Black Mass did too, as well.
Okay, so go.
So anyway,
sorry to interrupt.
So, So that's like one of the minor reasons. But then, you know, you said the kids. The kids are like beyond their years. Mm-hmm. I don't know how kids this young can do this well and not overacting.
Yes,
a play.
Yeah.
I don't know how that happens. And then the adults, top to bottom, the cast. So it was a great story. It was acted. You lost yourself for 2.5 hours. You weren't like thinking about other things in your life. You were thinking. You were totally engrossed in this story.
I'm so glad.
I can't. I mean, am I right, guys?
I'm so glad you guys got to see it. Really,
I just, I applaud all of you guys. And I mean, we have, it's like, I don't know your backgrounds. I probably should have done a little research and see how deeply you have been involved in the theater. I imagine some of you guys have worked a lot. You've been in Black Mass, obviously. You've been in some, you know, some heavy duty acting. But top to bottom, this cast is the best play I've ever seen anywhere. I've been to a lot of plays. Yeah. This is the best play I've ever seen.
Wow.
So you have to go see it. You still have a chance to go see it.
Yeah.
The play is going till the 17th.
Yeah.
You owe it to yourself to get out of your house.
27.
The 27th, okay. Till the 27th.
27th, and it's weekends, but there's also the final week of the show. There's a Tuesday night and a Thursday night in addition to the weekend performances.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm thinking about going again.
It's a worthwhile.
And we have chocolate chip cookies.
How many did we buy? How many cookies did we buy?
Nine, I think.
We legit bought 9 chocolate chip cookies. Well, there was different types, but they were all great. Well, we were coming from Sarka. We didn't get a chance to get any food in their belly, so it was.
No, it was good. We love that.
But Kim, I want you wanted to ask some questions.
Well, I did. I wrote down some questions.
Oh, great.
So, you know, one question I want to ask each of you is how do you feel it's relevant to today? But then I'll start with Lewis, and I think Atticus is a guiding light in the whole story because he sees all this. He sees evil, but he's hasn't lost his faith in humanity despite that.
We're going to lose her. She's welling up. Did you hear? Can you hear her voice? Pull it together.
So what drew you to the role of playing Atticus?
We all sort of know the story. I read it when I was 12. I've seen the movie. But yes, I think the injustice that happens within the play and the, you know, wonderful character of Atticus and trying to guide his, you know, children through this and seeing what's happening to Tom Robinson in the play through the eyes of his son and daughter who are experiencing things for the first time, you know, and asking, you know, very, very tough questions about, you know, why are you defending this man? And it's such a powerful role that touches you on so many different levels, you know. So it's a wonderful role to play.
Yeah, the kids really go through a whole. I mean, they're so innocent at first, and then they grow up during the play, basically. Right?
They sure do. It's a heartbreaking sort of, you know. Yeah. They grow up.
Do you feel like Scout kind of maintains her? A question I was going to have for Amanda was that Scout or Jean Louise maintains her innocent worldview or viewpoint, but I feel like Nathaniel, not so much. The Jeb, not so much. Mm. So, I mean, what did you think?
Well, I thought when I got the role, I did some researching on what this character is like. It's usually what I do when I get parts. What I mainly saw was that he was a very curious character, that he was eager to learn and he was daring and kind of wanted to know more, which is also what a lot of characters have. But with Boo Radley and Tom Robinson and the entire thing, Scout is more of a person who watches, and Jem wants to get involved, and Jem wants to help.
That's a good way, huh? That's an interesting viewpoint, huh?
I had a question.
Yeah.
How? So, you know, obviously it's racial things. You guys, the kids, well, you're the only really young one here. But, like, you know, they're saying nigger. Like, did the director get a hold of you guys ahead of time and say to you, this is how, you know, this is what's going on here, and this is to you. Like, how odd was it in the... hold up one second. Because how old is Jean Louise?
When she grows up, how old is she?
No, but how old
is Scout?
How
is
Carly? Carly, yeah.
Carly's 10. Is she 10 or 11?
She's 11 or 12.
She might be 11 or 12.
I think she's
12.
Yeah, 12.
Because
yeah.
This is like heavy material for youngsters. Like my daughters. You guys don't hear that kind of talk in school, do you?
Mm-mm.
Yeah? I mean, you got 10 and 12. I mean, it's just...
That's a good sign.
That's a good sign.
Positive steps.
Yeah, well, I mean... I think there has been changes. Did the director talk to you about these things ahead of time? Or does it just come... Or just say, you know, we're rational human beings that we can... You know, we don't... It's not something that I know I'm an actor and this is just what we do. You know what I mean?
Well, personally, Jem doesn't say it in the play at all, which I'm kind of thankful for. But that was definitely one of my worries beforehand for Scout, for whoever was playing Scout. I knew she had to say it. And immediately when I saw who it was on the first day of rehearsals, I just wanted to get to know her, see if she was comfortable with everything,
mm-hmm.
and just, even though that wasn't my job, I just wanted to make sure, because I was very worried, and I'm not sure if Judy went up to Carly and did talk to her about it, but it seemed like she was very comfortable with it, and she knew it was wrong, definitely,
yes,
she definitely knew it was wrong, but I feel like she was very comfortable with it, the actor she is, so.
It's just like the seamlessness...
Yeah,
I mean, on so many levels, I just don't know how children these ages can have that level of polish,
and I feel like
impressed me the most was just not the overdoing of everything.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, I think that's probably as an actor.
Yeah.
Is it more difficult to not overdo a part than it is to underdo a part? I mean, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The question?
I think it depends on where you are in your experience. You know, I think it's easy to overdo it when you're first starting,
mm-hmm.
and not really, you know, it takes time to sort of learn those sorts of things.
Mm.
And then you also get times when a director will say, well, give me more, and go as far as you can go, because I can always reel you in.
Right, right.
So that's the other nice thing about, you know, depending on what your character is like, you may just want to take it as far as you can and play with that for a bit, and then find where the character is.
Yeah.
And come back and find that.
Well, I mean, I was told, like, years ago when I kind of first started acting, and I don't know if this is good advice or bad advice, but it worked for me that... there's no such thing as overacting if it's justified.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for Tom Robinson, you know, if he were to literally collapse on the ground, you know, when the verdict is, you know, said, and sob and panic, you know, is that overacting or is that justified? Because that's
right,
his
right.
life on the line.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know.
I think if it's real and truthful and honest, it can be huge,
right.
you know, and as long as it's believable. But also, I will say, it also can depend, you know, it's helpful with the space that you're in. If you're in a big 800-seat theater with giant, you know, curtain and proscenium, there's a you know, kind of tendency sometimes to be a larger, you know, performance. But wonderful thing with Gloucester Stage or smaller theaters is those people are right there.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of intimacy that, like, it keeps it real because you can have a direct connection to those people.
Yeah.
And so that keeps you honest.
Yeah.
What was amazing as well, I mean, as deep as the story is, and the laughs, Just a, you know what I mean? Like interspersed. I just can't. I found myself like, it's a roller coaster. Yeah. It was just a roller coaster. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I don't know who got the most, some of the, I don't know. I just like.
Calpurnia.
No, I know. Yeah. It was just some of her, the things that she was saying and her, it's just, and the kids, everybody, I just.
It's really nice to have like those moments of comedy because it's a tense play and it's a heavy topic. So when we get to laugh, you see the audience are like, oh, yeah. Oh my God. You know, like immediately after the court scene when we see the children up there and everyone's like, oh, thank God, we get to laugh. you feel the room sigh.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think especially now, if you look at the play in the context of what's going on in the rest of the world, you know, you really need to have that. Like, it's interesting, we had a high school matinee the other day, and when we got to the scene at the end where Nate gets attacked, you would have thought the place was coming down.
Yeah.
Because they just started screaming. And I was relating this
everyone.
We thought something happened.
We were literally thinking that something was coming down. Everyone was just roaring.
And I was relating this to Charlie Linshaw, who helped us, who was our dialect coach. And he said, do you think this is, you know, bubbling up from school shootings? And I thought, wow, that had never even occurred to me. Mm.
But that's a kid. That's
be
a child's
sensitivities that are, that this was,
good point.
So with everything that's going on, I think.
But then right before.
I don't think it's by accident that this play is playing, I mean, they did this play this at this point in time, right?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously.
Right before Jem gets attacked, back to your point about, you know, the whole place erupted in laughter when Carly showed up in the hands.
Applause.
Applause and laughter.
They gave her a round of applause.
For the ham costume. And then then it was we were in the lobby and we're like, what was that all about? I'm like, well, she just came in the ham costume. And so the ham costume set them. It was applause and laughing, and then the attack, and then it was a different. So I mean, those kids were on the same roller coaster ride that you were on, know.
I think that's the part of the beauty of the story is being told through a child's eyes, and that's what children experience, is that everything in their life can be, you know, especially during rocky periods, can feel like a roller coaster.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And Joy, you just mentioned how that this play being done at this time period, you know, I mean, right now in our current world. Excuse me. And I think that's what's interesting. The book was written in 1960, takes place in 1935.
Yeah.
Here we are in 2017. So much has changed in the world and in terms of racism and more equality, but we still have such a long way to go. You know, when you look at, police shootings of unarmed black motorists, gerrymandering of congressional districts, suppressing black voters in certain states. And these issues are still happening today.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, the play touches on so many things. I think actually, Cheryl, you brought up in rehearsal, you know, in the play, without giving too much away, but we know the story, Tom, when he's in prison, is shot 17 times. And supposedly he's climbing over the fence. With one arm. Is he really climbing over the fence?
It was
the exercise period.
Yeah.
Right.
There's no YouTube video to show us what really happened. Maybe he was just running around the exercise field and got shot 17 times because they wanted to shoot him. So like something like that didn't occur to me, but in today's world when that can happen in the streets of anywhere in America, is kind of chilling. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Immediately, like that scene, when the policeman came to tell you that, you know, because thankfully I didn't remember, honestly, I didn't remember how it all played out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he took his own life rather than having a white man decide it for him.
It was actually Atticus's line.
Right.
I told Tom we had a chance. But I think he preferred. He got tired of waiting for white men's chances and preferred to take his own.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Jumping over the thing. Yeah. Oh God, it was just something.
Just on a more happy note, I wanted to ask Aaron. I met your parents at the Franklin opening night, I wanted to ask you about this at the last podcast. Like, have they always supported your dreams of becoming an actor? And
Yeah, totally. I mean, my parents have been, thank God for them. They've been doing this with me since middle school, and they've always been extremely supportive, driving me to rehearsals, going to all my shows, even when I'm like third aunt on the right, which was a real role.
Third aunt?
Oh, I was a great aunt. I had like little like extra legs. It was amazing.
Especially when you and mom, you were the greatest. But they were here all the way from Atlanta. I was really touched to see them here opening night.
Yeah, my stepmom was like, "I'm gonna make a scrapbook." Yeah.
I think most theater moms and dads are probably. But I mean, it's, for Atlanta, that's a hike.
That's a long drive.
How did you end up in Boston?
Well, I went to BU, and I just graduated in May, so back in maybe May or April, I auditioned for this role with Judy Braha, the director. But I was like, listen, I'm going back to Atlanta. I'm like, that's where I'm from, that's where I'm going to spend the summer, that's where I live. But you, and luckily Bob Walsh, the artistic director of Gloucester Stage, was like, listen, we can offer you housing if you're willing to come up for this. And I was like, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%. So, made the check.
Not a bad place to be.
Have you guys all, not Nathaniel, because I know he lives here, but have you guys all enjoyed your stay in Gloucester? Like,
absolutely.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah, it's been great.
So you'd come back.
Mm-hmm. We're dying to come back.
Hopefully we get to see every one of these actors in more plays because they're all that good.
Yeah,
and they're all sweet. They've all made it a great experience for the kids too, all the adult actors, because it can be a little intimidating. Nate, text from Nate, how are you doing? Terrified. How's rehearsal? Are you how's, you know, tomorrow's the first day of rehearsal. Terrified. And I was like, why? You know what you're doing. You know what you're doing. You can hold your own. You'll
but
be
you
fine.
Have to. Yeah, at the, yeah. I mean, but, you had, what a how much confidence? Okay, so what was your confidence level acting before this play, and what is your confidence level now?
Well, I've always done school shows and small shows with Heidi and the Yaw program.
Small shows? Thank you,
Nate. All right. Pretty big
place. I'll cut in the YAW program. It's the Youth Acting Workshop.
Yeah.
Right.
So I've been an active member there for a while. And when I got this role, I was thrilled. But then I came to, like, September. It was, like, the beginning of September. And rehearsals were next week. So I was kind of like, okay, like, this is all fun. But what now? And I started, like, panicking.
How long did you have to do to remember the dialogue? That's a lot of lines.
2.5 weeks of rehearsal.
Well, you guys started a week before.
Yeah, the kids were. So the half was like a half.
Carly, Gabe, and Amanda, and you started rehearsals.
But you know, when the cast list came out, when the first kind of cast list came out in the spring, and they got emails, little Gabriel McGee, not so little anymore, but. Gabriel McGee looked at the cast list and Googled everyone on the cast list to find out about them.
Yeah.
And I hope he's not upset that I'm saying. So he found Aaron, and Aaron has a really awesome website. And he went to Aaron's website and he emailed Aaron, and Aaron emailed him back. And he was like, "Hey, I'm Dill in To Kill a Mockingbird." And he was like, "Yeah, let's do this. I can't wait to work together."
It was amazing.
You know?
Okay, so anybody that hasn't seen the play, wait to see who Dill is, and like how little Dill is, and he's unbelievable.
Just adorable. Yeah. And he's been acting since he came when he was 4 years old to Youth Acting Workshop. I let him in early because his brother and sister were both in it. and there was a whole car full of probably 10 kids, the Turners, you know, that all came together, and a different mother would drive, and everyone would get out of the SUV, and little Gaby would be left alone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he would cry because he was left. And so Martha emailed me and said, you know, would you just let Gabe try it? Do you think? And I mean, he's adorable, and he's so sweet.
So
and I was
charismatic,
like,
that
kid. And I was like, sure. I'm like, I'll try him. Let's try him in class. And of course, he followed every direction.
Yeah.
You know, as a 4-year-old in Holiday Delights, he had all his costumes. There's 100 costume changes. All his stuff was all, he was always got on stage at the right time. In rehearsals, in between scenes, he'd sit in my lap and put his head on my shoulder when we'd watch
So, Madeline, he would not have been, when we went to the middle school play in the late, and we were at the rehearsal, and the director was screaming at the kids, saying, if I hear one cell phone, I'm going to tell you. Well, you do it. You do it.
I can't do it.
Have to do it. Please, this will make the whole podcast if you do this. Please. I'm begging you. Go ahead. Be the director.
If I hear one cell phone ring, I'm going to send you back to preschool.
Yes.
And then she followed it up with, I'm going to tell your mother. And I'm going to, go ahead.
I'm going to tell your mother.
And I'm going to enjoy telling your mother. That was the line. You missed the line.
I remember that. Oh, I have to steal that one.
It was just.
Was this to that cast or to the audience?
No, we were at a dress rehearsal.
Oh.
No, it was a run. It was like a 10-minute run through before they let anyone into the thing. We were there as media, let us in, and so.
it was like the play before the play, last.
Yeah.
You know, as podcaster, you couldn't see it, but there was a little honeycomb stare in there.
Honeycomb stare, that's right. The honeycomb stare. Nate, you didn't answer my question. What was your 1 to 10 level of confidence before and after?
Well, beforehand, 0 being no confidence, 10 being so ready. I was about a 0 beforehand.
I don't believe it.
No, yeah,
I had to be some
confident.
I wasn't confident at all. I didn't think I could do this. I shivered at night. I had nightmares about it. Wow. I still do. but that's a different story.
Welcome to having actor nightmares.
Yeah, right.
We all do.
But yeah, probably at 0-1, I was like, I had Gabe, so I kind of raised it up a level because I knew Gabe because we did Holiday Delights. But yeah, it was definitely down.
Where'd you end up?
What's
where did you end up?
I've done shows before, school shows, and I'm so scared. And I don't know why. I'm like, I have butterflies. Opening night here, I wasn't scared. I didn't have butterflies. Because I was around such strong actors. So I was about a 9, a 10.
Yeah,
wow. I was really
That's
high.
Awesome.
Because
smart.
I had Gabe, I had... Not only did I have Gabe, I had Carly, I had Aaron, I had Lewis.
Hey.
I had all these people that I now were friends with.
Yeah.
And it was just...
But what do I tell you before every show? I tell every kid this before every show. You have no reason to be nervous on opening night. You have no reason, no need to be nervous, upset, worried. If you've done the work,
mm-hmm.
you've come to rehearsal, you're prepared, go out and enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
So that's exactly...
And Mr. Robinson, how about your confidence level?
You know, it's ever changing by the day, but I was having this moment yesterday. It's really nice to hear you talk about your journey, because I had this moment yesterday in which I just sat and was reflecting, I guess, of where we started and kind of where we are now. I mean, we were yesterday before the nighttime show, we were tossing a football around together, almost the whole cast, and it's just the first day we came into the rehearsal room, I mean, we knew we were dealing with something heavy. We knew, this is the group of people we have to deal with this with. And, you know, the content is kind of rough, and you know, the N-word's getting thrown around.
Yeah.
So, everyone kind of was walking on eggshells a little bit coming into the room, which was actually nice, given the material. But we look at it now, and now we're backstage being like so ruthless with each other.
Yeah.
So mean, like,
yeah.
Just like the development of a family, and then you have this moment, and after the show, in which we more or less walk out together to like greet the audience, and you see that like this thing that has almost become so, I don't want to say standard, but just our lives for the time being, is actually affecting people and actually touching people, and you really feel like, I did this not alone, I did this with this group of people, and it's the only way that this could have been done. Mm-hmm. So like my confidence level is you know, like I said, ever changing, but like my confidence in this family is so solidified now, and mm-hmm. it's just insane. I can't imagine what it will be like to close this.
Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah.
So we have another talk back next Sunday after the show. So next Sunday, is that the...
Yeah, and we have one today after the show, too. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
The 22nd.
It's the 22nd next Sunday.
Yeah, next Sunday is the 22nd, so there's another talk back after the show, and you don't have to come to the show that day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's say, mm-hmm. Joey, you had a burning question next Sunday. Next Sunday at 5, if you go to the theater, you can just walk in and they're free.
Yeah.
So if anyone's come to any of the shows, you can come back on Sunday after the show.
Oh,
the talkbacks are super fun because you get to, you know, just have all these. There's kind of like a podcast in a way for that.
Yes, Kim was a guest for a talkback.
Do you guys? So obviously the talkbacks. Are you still in your
change.
So, okay, so this is like a big thing for my daughters just now. It's like, oh my god, it's so weird to see them not as their characters.
Right?
Yeah, they were so Well, I really want to thank you guys for coming in. Thank you for the gift of that performance. It was like I said, how many more superlatives can we throw at this thing? When I say, okay, this is the thing. When I say no-brainer, right? Isn't that my go-to thing?
Yes.
When I 100% believe in something, I always say, I put the no-brainer tag on it. This is a no-brainer.
Yes.
Like, you have to go see this.
And I like what you just said about it being a gift to the community, because that truly is a gift.
Anybody that sees this is going to walk away and feel I don't need to say any more words. Then, you know, you just have to go see.
And you were three generations who came to the show yesterday, because your mom came with you too.
My mom was very excited because we don't get, I work it so much this time of year, I don't get to see her that
really
often
sweet.
And get her together with the kids.
Yeah, right.
And so yeah,
great.
Everybody.
Three generations, mm-hmm. and you were all touched by the show. So really, is a great.
Yeah, yeah. I just go. Just go.
Just go.
I'm just glad people are coming and taking a good message away. And, you know, hopefully, everyone does something with the message, you know?
I would think, you know, you can't go to the show and not take something away from it. I mean, you know, people that are normal people, rational people to begin with, you know, there's something for everybody. You know what I mean? Like, there's the different emotions, the laughing, the crying, the highs and the lows, and the story, and how the author of this original play, you know, tied up so much. You know, you see how they work, why this is considered the American masterpiece, because of how brilliantly it was written.
You know, people think that these kind of things just pop out of somebody, but it took Harper Lee 5 years to write it, and her editor should probably have part of the credit, because this went on back and forth for 5 years, tuning the book, which, you know, then the play came from that. But
yeah, anyway. Bravo to every one of you guys. I mean, sometimes you go to shows and there's some people that you can single out, and you can single out an actor, like in that, what was the one with the beauty shop parlor, and there was the girl with the big boobs,
Out of Sterno,
like that girl kind of stole the show in that movie, in that play.
Hilarious.
But like this play, you can't.
Right.
There's not one. Everybody gave a 10 plus. Everybody. I mean, top to bottom, this ensemble. I don't want to. Everybody. Calpurnia. Everybody gave a 10 plus performance. My favorite performance I've ever seen live, and without question.
We give you the Tony Award.
Yes. Wow. Hand it to him right now.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming. Thanks again for coming, guys.
Thank you.
All right, we're back. That was such a great piece with that cast, and they were the only cast we've ever had back twice for good reason. And we're not going to linger on that, but go see To Kill a Mockingbird. Melissa Cox, my good friend, is here. She's running for city councilor at large, leaving her seat that she probably could have had into infinity as Ward 2 city councilor, what I consider the most important ward. And
I would have to agree with you, but I'm biased.
So. Ward 2 downtown, yeah. You know, which it covers a lot of ground, but like the heart of the city. Anybody that doesn't think the heart of the city is the most important part,
it influences so much of what goes on.
There's no question.
The community,
But I wanted to say, and that Ken Hecht was in here, and he's running for Ward 2, the seat that you're vacating. And you said the guy that's running against him is who?
Joe Gigoloni.
Joe Gigoloni needs to know that he is welcome to come in. We don't play favorites on the blog. Any candidate that's running right now is welcome to come in and tell us why they're running. Which leads me to...
You say that, but I know I'm your favorite.
It's true. You know, I do have love for you. Tell me why the change from a ward counselor to a counselor at large.
Well, my cousin is in the U.S. Navy, and she was originally supposed to take command of a ship for her last tour, and she asked Bill and I if we would be willing to watch her daughter while she took the ship, and of course we said yes. So I announced early on to give people the opportunity to make a decision to run for two, and then, of course, with all things military, it changed, and she is now in charge of missile defense for Eastern Europe, and she only had to take a ship out for 6 weeks. So she's currently off the coast of Scotland throwing around missiles, leading a 9-country missile defense task force and exercise, and so I have her daughter right now.
She's adorable.
15 months old, and... Wow. Utterly adorable and utterly exhausting.
Wow, yeah, that goes. That's a tremendous responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, going from 0 to 15 months, and she was 14 when I got her, but, you know, it's been interesting, so...
She is awesome. She's been so good. She's a cute kid.
She really is, and of course she's here with me right now, and so is my husband Bill. So he is managing the animal and entertaining her. So it's good. It's a good mixture with Bill and Priya. They're about the same age.
Hey, wait a second.
Go ahead.
So when we found out she wasn't going to be out at sea for 2 years, we discussed it, and I decided that I wasn't really done. I'm not ready to be done with city council. So out of respect of the two who had already announced that they were going to run for Ward 2, I decided to try my hand at large. So it's a huge risk. There's 7 people running for 4 spots. All 4 returning at-large councilors are running again, plus some other really good candidates. So, I mean, it's going to be a challenge. I haven't been able to campaign in the manner that I liked because of having Priya with me, but, you know, we went door-to-door in Rocky Neck. I put her in the backpack, and we went door-to-door, and we had a blast. So, yeah. Met a lot of wonderful people, and it's just a little bit slower of a pace.
You do have a body of work running when you have never run before, like Ken, has to campaign,
right?
Because no one really knows, but people know your body of work, so that has to be a little bit of a relief to you.
Right, but I've also been very Ward 2 centric.
Mm-hmm.
So Lanesville, Magnolia, while there's still a lot of people that know my name, they may have never met me, you know.
But civically, before you were ever even involved in politics, you were so involved with the cleanups and, you know, you were out and you were doing things before you ever even campaigned or did anything politically, you were already involved in the community. So,
right.
You know, that's not like some politicians or candidates, they start to run for something, and then all of a sudden you see them showing up for all the different events. It's
yeah.
like, wait a second, I never saw you before in my life at this
right.
ribbon cutting or this yeah. business open, and all of a sudden you're here or you know, the lighting of the tree. You know, never saw you at any of these things. Now you're like jumping to get in the front of the picture.
But that's my favorite with the current candidates. They only show up during election year at these ribbon cuttings or events, and that floors me. I mean, if you're always involved, no one can ever question motivation.
Yeah.
So, but you're right. When I first moved here, I volunteered with the chamber. I volunteered at the senior center. I was doing cleanups with Donna when they first started. I love this area. I've lived all over the U.S. and outside of the U.S. I've never thought about settling down. I never thought about buying a house. And I got here and it was home. It was immediate connection. I never felt like an outsider. I mean, this is my home. This is where I'm going to be for the next...
ever. So I also like the way that... that you're not, I'll say this about you, that when you make decisions, it doesn't seem like there's a left or right or like a national, you know, you're not going with some type of an agenda. It's, you're just looking at each issue and making a decision on its merits.
Well, that's the luxury I have. I, you know, while I have a lot of friends here and I consider a lot of these people family, that, you know, I don't own a business here. I own my house. I pay taxes like everybody else. It's, I mean, it is what it is. There's no bias. So,
yeah.
And I think having that clean relationship is actually really handy.
Yeah. So what? So I'm going to ask you, like I asked every other person that's come in that's running before. What are some of the things, I say low hanging fruit, and I don't know if it throws people off, but what are some of the things that you think that you get elected that you'd like to tackle?
So in my 6 years as a Ward 2 city councilor, there's a lot of things that you learn about that you wouldn't have really known before. So we have a lot of city owned property that is underutilized. So vacant lots, you know, things that we've got through tax title or whatnot, developable land, tracts of land that are large. And I think that some of those things can be looked at as locations for new schools or possible housing or affordable housing, you know, senior housing, anything like that. And there's lots of smaller tracts of land that could be sold. There's a property on Warner Street that was taken for tax title. It's now a parking lot, but it's not on the tax rolls because the city owns it. So therefore we have to maintain it and, you know, take care of it. Whereas if we sold that piece of property to maybe one of the houses next door that needs parking, that's a four-unit property, then it's back on the tax roll. I mean, we have to look at each individual property on its own merits to decide if we want to develop, keep it as is, or sell it. There's just a lot of potential there.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things that I learned through my time on budget and finance. And there's also, you know, I-4C-2. We've had that property as city-owned for a long time. You know, it's great that it's bringing in revenue as a parking lot, but that's a short-term solution for revenue. We need a long-term. And I know the administration's been working on it. We've been going to the Boston Seafood Show trying to attract businesses in. It's a limited-use property, so it's going to be difficult. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff like that. City Hall. It's a beautiful venue. We need to utilize it more and open it more for artist presentations, shows. You know, you could do it by a lottery and open it one weekend a month. The most you need is a custodian to man it. You know, it's stuff like that. We need to start thinking outside the box to make Gloucester more marketable for everything, for retail, for businesses to come, for artists to come. Our local artists to utilize. I mean, you got the American Legion, the upstairs is a beautiful building. They just redid the floors. It's fabulous up there. The kitchen could use some work, but, you know, we're working on it.
Mm.
There's just even all of our schools, they all have an auditorium. They all have the ability to host outside shows, but the cost is a custodian to it. You know, the lights are on regardless.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's utilize the property. Let's help out our artists that are here in town by providing them a place to showcase their work and advertise the hell out of it.
Mm. So. A lot of great ideas right there. Kim, do you have any questions?
No, I just, I would like to say that I think that you've just done a phenomenal job in
Thank
the
you.
Time that you've had on, that you've been here. How many terms has it been?
Three,
6 years.
Don't you think terms should be 4 years instead of two?
Oh, absolutely.
It's
exhausting.
And wait, I just want to say one more thing.
That's
all right. I just want to say one more thing is I'm especially appreciative of the work that you've done with the Clean City Commission, with Ainsley, and with the ban on plastic bag and getting the ban on styrofoam through. So
yeah.
I think that's really, really awesome that you did that.
She's, there's a lot. Okay.
Yeah.
I can't.
Is that too political?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
Not at all.
Sorry.
I'm happy to. I just like. See, we're friends.
Yeah.
But on top of it, like, if I could erase the friend part of it, like, Melissa has a laundry list of initiatives that she has done. Like,
right.
Burnham's Field. Like,
right.
There's a laundry list of things
right.
that are above and beyond. Like, could have just. Sometimes there are politicians that get on there and they just sleep. You see them falling asleep in their seat at city council.
Right.
And they're just putting
it's
in
literally
and
happening.
They're just putting in and they're just putting in time.
Right.
And a proactive pro business, pro art leadership is nice.
Right.
Is all I'll say.
Yes.
In all city, any city council. Okay, here's how I'll couch it. Any city councilor that has those qualities, I really enjoy those type of city councilors.
So, three of my proudest moments, and you know these, like you said, Burns Field, definitely. I mean, we've completely renovated that, and we're not done yet. We got this huge grant from the state. We did a complete renovation, and then every year since then, we've applied for CPA or community block development grants to continue the work. So in the next few weeks, we're going to have more lights installed at Burns Field, and we're finishing the inside pathway. So that way you don't have to go outside the fence line. You can, you know, set your kids free and let them walk the track. And it's just, it's amazing.
Did she just say mama?
Yes.
Oh, Jesus. Uh-oh. Yikes.
Hopefully your sister is not listening to the podcast.
My cousin.
Your cousin.
Yeah. No. And, well, she said bye this morning, which, like, we were just astonished.
Aww.
So she's starting to say words. We've been actually teaching her to say mama, so when she gets home, she's, you know, so holding up pictures of mom. Anyway. The second is the hotel, the Beauport Hotel. It's amazing. It's brought a lot of revenue to the city, a lot of jobs. It's brought a lot of headache as well, but it's, you know, there's with anything that we have that's major in the city, they're going to be growing pains. And then my work on the tourism board. I was on the tourism board for my first 4 years as a city councilor and helped transition to the Discover Gloucester, and now it's thriving. It's great. So my background is in marketing and tourism marketing, so that's what I went to college for. And it's been fabulous. And then when that was working through, we didn't have a tourism board for a little while, and then I became the liaison for the Downtown Development Commission. So then Joe Orlando picked up the tourism board and redeveloped that, which is amazing. He's done a lot of work with that. And a lot of younger groups, a lot of younger people on the board now, which is great.
That's
so
great.
Now we're hitting it from two sides. We've got the city tourism board and then the collaborative with Gloucester, Discover Gloucester, which is amazing. And they're doing a lot of good work. They're going to a lot of trade shows and, you know, it's really good for the city. So.
Nice to get that group working together.
Right.
Together.
Right. Yeah.
Underlined, in quotation marks, underlined, italicized,
both
together.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. You know, and working with the DDC has been great. You know, obviously you know where my heart lies in the downtown area. So,
you know,
there's just a lot of things that I'm really proud of. And even as simple as, you know, helping the guy down the street get a handicap spot, or, you know, getting a pothole fixed. Those things are just as important because you're helping people with their lives and getting things
making their lives a little better.
Yeah.
I feel like here's my thought process. My thought process is hopefully whoever gets into Ward 2 as a counselor, like, they take your example and runs with it. But there's a potential for a double banger because I know that Melissa cares so much that anybody asks her about like a city council type of problem, she's probably gonna act on that as well because she's almost gonna be like a Ward 2 counselor slash city councilor that cares about everything.
And Ward 2 is so busy that it literally could use two. It really could.
Yeah.
So to have the Ward 2 counselor and the and at-large counselors actually working together and supporting each other, I know how hard it is to manage Ward 2. It's difficult. So having that firsthand knowledge back on the council as an at-large candidate is going to be huge.
That's huge.
Yeah.
That is huge.
And I know that regardless of who gets elected in Ward 2, and hopefully I get reelected as an at-large counselor, that, you know, we're going to work well together because that's what we do. We don't do it for ourselves. We don't do it for each other. We do it for the greater good of the city.
The council in the past, I don't know, say 10 years or so, has gotten better and better and better. A lot less. It seems to me, I'm not an insider, but it seems to me there's a lot more working together and for the greater good of the city as opposed to, fracture.
You're so cute and naive.
It's what I kind of, it's. I don't know, it's maybe because
hey, you
of...
You know what, if that's... I like to think that, too. I mean, we've had some hiccups along the way, but we're going to do that with any nine body working with administration, those things. And that's having a respectful relationship with not just the administration but the other counselors is key.
Mm.
You know, you can agree to disagree and then go have a drink.
You
know,
you have to.
It's super important that you have that relationship and not everybody does.
Yeah,
so.
I'm sure. Yeah. Listen, thank you so much.
Thank
I know you have responsibilities, big time responsibilities to we're looking down on right now.
Yes.
And Bill, thanks for coming in and helping out, Bill.
Oh, no problem.
And,
if I might, when you get a chance, I'd like to put a shameless plug in for Phyllis A. We have a scrap metal drive coming up on November 4th.
Absolutely. We just posted about it yesterday, I think it was.
Okay.
Someone sent in a press release. They're doing
so
a good job. Whoever's doing that, those press releases, tell them to keep it up. They're doing a good job.
Yeah.
Melissa, thanks.
Heavy metal, just not the Judas Priest kind.
Yeah.
You know, steel, you know, that sort of heavy metal.
Bring it on in.
Sorry.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
All done.
Our next guest is Ainsley Smith.
Good morning.
Ainsley, have we ever met?
I don't think we have. I've met Kim several times at events now.
Ainsley Smith, her name has come up probably the last three or four podcasts in a row.
Right. I'm flattered.
Well, because what is exact? Are you the chair of the Clean City Commission?
Yes, of the Clean City Commission. Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of groups in Gloucester doing cleanup type things. There's Donna's group.
Right, mm-hmm. 1 hour at a time.
1 hour at a time, gang.
Then there's Clean Gloucester.
Clean Gloucester.
Yeah, right. Which is the Clean City Commission's Facebook page name.
Oh, okay.
All right. So that's us.
And then there's One Ocean, One Love. They kind of do certain things. Then there's the Gloucester Beach cleanup people thing.
Right. What's that? Is that also under you as well?
We work with One Ocean, One Love, and the Cape Ann Maritime Partnership is sort of an alliance. We're trying to get everybody working
together
because there are so many
moving
interested
parts.
Parties.
Yeah.
We can do so much more when we're all on the same page. So we're getting there.
Yeah,
that's great.
I think the main reason she was brought to our attention were the cigarette
butlers.
And the little things that you can put in your car for smokers instead of throwing the cigarette butts out the car. Are you giving out those?
Yep, we have free ashtrays that came with the grant that we received for the cigarette butlers.
Oh.
So we've been handing them out this year. It's been a lot of fun.
So how did you apply for that, or how did that go down?
Yep, so I've been on the commission for just over a year now, and before I was even there, the idea of getting cigarette butlers in was one of their main goals. So when I got on, I found out about a grant through Keep America Beautiful, and we applied to that last winter, and we found out in the spring that we were receiving $2,500, and we were the only group in New England this year getting that award.
That's
so we're pretty thrilled about that. And it was enough money to buy right now 20 units of the cigarette butlers that you've seen around town.
Mm-hmm.
And it also came with a couple hundred pocket-sized ashtrays and car cup holder ashtrays, too, as part of their cigarette litter reduction program.
Yeah, because how many times do you, a smoker in front of you driving,
yeah,
and
driving,
he's like,
cigarette
right
all over the curbs
and
the gutters,
Yeah, just like racism. It's just like, I feel like, more and more awareness of like these. I just don't. You know how racism was much more prevalent, obviously, like in the 70s or whatever, and gradually, obviously it's still around, but much to a lesser degree, right? Like, hopefully, we can do the same thing with cigarette butt people that think that it's okay to flick a cigarette butt out a window.
Yeah.
Because they're both awful things. I mean, they're both terrible, terrible, terrible things. I mean, not everyone can agree on that, right?
Yes.
But how does like the guy with the cigarette not come to the realization that the fiberglass filter is not going to break down for so many years?
Yeah, people don't realize that. And it's one of the most commonly littered items around the world at this point. The Ocean Conservancy does data collection every year. And cigarette butts are always at the top of the list because they're just so easy and they're so small. People don't think about how they accumulate over time. And we've got all sorts of data and numbers to show that they're a huge problem around here.
I can't go into the whole block party thing again. I can't do it.
I know.
Needless to say, back when we started the block parties, after the block party, we got the permits to do the block parties, and part of the thing was that we were going to make sure we left the street cleaner than it was, so that they could never say we can't have block parties because you make a mess and you don't pick it up. So the block party committee would walk the street at 12 o'clock at night. At every single block party, there were certain areas where there would be sidewalks, and the sidewalks would be at a 45-degree angle, completely filled in with cigarette butts we picked up because we wanted to. We were doing this street sweep and would make sure that everything got cleaned up, and it just
gross,
very gross. And it was back then. This is a long time ago now. You know, the cigarette butlers, I think one was installed like in front of the Empire Building.
Oh, really?
A long time ago. I remember they did, like, it was like one of those, you know, there's the hole in the top, and it goes down to a base.
Some of the restaurants have purchased units like that on their own.
Aren't they great ideas?
Yeah,
and absolutely. How many have you placed around town?
We have 18 that we have put up through the grant, and then there's one in West Gloucester that Jen maintains that was a private donation from a former commissioner.
Jen Holmgren?
Yes.
That's how you, okay,
yep,
there you
so
go.
There's
it's
all
kind of come together. Yeah. Jen Holmgren, nice person. Yeah, and she maintains that. She goes there and she gets the cigarette butts.
It's not
just nasty. So that's a nice thing she does.
Yeah. That's a very I like the one that's at the Harbor Walk. It's right there in a very prominent place. It's right at Gosford Park with a bench where people smoke all the time.
Yeah.
So
and Seven Seas actually purchased that one.
Oh, they
so
did.
They take care of that now.
Okay.
So we're starting to get businesses engaged in the process that want to.
Right.
Take this responsibility, which is absolutely wonderful, and we're so glad that they're involved in the process now.
That's fantastic. So what initiatives do you have coming up?
So the cigarette butlers we're so excited that that's moving along. We have a little bit of funding left this winter, so we'll probably be buying a few more of those.
Okay.
We just had a great cleanup yesterday at Good Harbor Beach. We're going to keep doing those throughout
the fall.
We
met Ainsley there yesterday.
Pat and Jim were there?
Yes, we were there. There was a big old drizzle going on. But despite that, I don't know what your normal numbers are, but I was very impressed with how many people. And here's the thing that impressed me the most. They reused the collection bags.
Yep.
Talk about reusing.
They walk the walk.
Yes, exactly.
It
was like, whoa.
Yeah. DPW was kind enough to leave the dumpsters open for us so we could just keep dumping out our yellow bags as people filled them up so we can use those one more time.
Great.
But we had about 45 people join us.
That's tremendous.
So it was a fantastic turnout despite being
not such a
great
day. Great
weather.
You know, Pat did a post on that, so maybe you could put a link to it.
A couple pictures
up there.
A link to what?
On our page, too.
To Pat's post on Good Harbor Beach. The
Good Harbor Beach
cleanup?
I'll link to that for sure. Who maintains the cigarette butlers that Ms. Holmgren doesn't maintain?
Yep, so Jen's got hers, and Seven Seas takes care of the one in front of their property. And right now, the commissioners have divided them up into zones, but we'd eventually love to work with some of the businesses have expressed interest and other volunteers. So we're working on the logistics of passing over the reins to some of them as well.
What do you mean the commission? So who does it right now?
The ones
that aren't by those two people?
There are four commissioners right now. Eric Majors, Bev Lowe, and Nicolatis, and myself.
And they're taking care
So you have committed to taking care of these things? Wow.
And we've seen great results.
Yeah.
The sidewalks in those areas are so much cleaner. The units are being used. We're just thrilled.
That's very nice. You know, part of the theme the other day when I was walking from the Cape Ann Community Cinema to the Franklin for dinner, like just walking down, it's just so beautiful. The West End and our downtown is so gorgeous.
Yeah. Do you have a cigarette butler right around there?
We have several, and I have a map for you too.
Oh, nice. Is there a map online?
We're working on that part next. I want to make it a little bit cleaner. But
when you do it,
yes,
please email it to me.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So there are 10 on Main Street right now, all the way from Stone's Pub, all the way up Jalapenos, Cafe Sicilia, all the way over to Cafe Brew and Spirits.
Okay.
So we're everywhere.
I imagine this. so that's great.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. You know, I'm needed. This is a needed thing.
It is.
Long overdue.
Yes.
And it's great for you guys.
It's
people like Ainsley that it's just taken the step to apply for the grant and gets it done and then walks the walk of emptying the things out.
Because a lot of you
see things that happen that are great things, but if there's not a commitment to follow through all the way through, it can actually fall apart, and then people lose faith.
I have a question. What's the process to empty those?
Because
you said some businesses, you would love to have other businesses pick that up. So Why don't you explain what that is?
Sure.
What's the process?
So it's a very easy design, and it's just, it sort of looks like a metal birdhouse, and at the bottom is a specific screw, so we all have tools to unscrew it, and the cylinder inside just drops out, and with one hand you just flip it over into your bucket and put the lid back on your bucket and pop it back in and screw it.
And then where does everything that was in the bucket go?
So DPW was kind enough to give us a little Rubbermaid shed over at their facility, and we have a metal trash can in there.
Okay.
So every couple weeks when our personal buckets are full, we bring them over to DPW and we put them in the metal trash can, and we make sure that everything's cool in there. And then we're going to be sending them to a company called TerraCycle that actually breaks them apart with a special machine, and it separates out the cotton and the fibers and the little plastic fiberglass piece inside, so the organic pieces can be composted, and the fiberglass inside can be melted down, and they put it into sort of plastic pellets, and they're making it into products like pallets and sort of industrial plastic items. And I think my
this is part of cigarettes for all you smokers out there.
All this extra, I mean, just seems just amazing to me that you guys are taking this on, because it's just a lot of steps, a lot of work, a lot of, you know, a lot of following through.
It's nice that there's people with that kind of passion.
Yeah.
It's very nice.
And I think my favorite part about it is, so TerraCycle, when they receive it, they weigh it and tell us how many pounds of cigarettes we've collected. And for every pound, they donate back to Keep America Beautiful to fund more grants.
More.
So it becomes this self-filling role.
Wow.
So
tremendous.
Next year we'll be able to apply for another grant, and we benefit from sending everything back in and filling this process.
Brilliant.
Can I just ask Ainsley a personal question? Like, what was your background that made you want to get so involved in the Clean City Commission?
So I have my master's in environmental management. So I've always been a biologist, a marine biologist, in my full-time job. And when I moved to Gloucester a couple years ago, I started getting involved with Donna's group, the 1 hour at a time cleanups, and some of the cleanups that were happening around the city. And Amy Kerr was vacating her seat on the commission, and she suggested it to me that this would be a good role to step up my involvement.
Wow.
That's great. Yeah. And then where do you work locally?
A government contractor.
Here, and you live here in Gloucester?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, great.
She just said government contractor. I feel like there's like she's like the Bourne identity. Jason Bourne. She's Jason Bourne. She is. She's Jason. There's something going on. I feel like there's something going on. She's going to hop in some fancy car. There's going to be like some double agents, like snipers on the rooptop. They're going to like come they're going to come down on the paracord. I'm scared to death right now. Like, someone's got a scope on me right now. Like, in the window. I just saw like a laser beam. It's like right on her temple.
She's very beautiful.
Exciting.
I can see her in the whole, like, with her hair down in a trench coat.
Oh, yeah. I wish it was that glamorous. It's not.
Jim.
The car ashtrays, how are they distributed?
We've been passing them out to different businesses throughout the last couple months. So most recently, we brought some up to Sean Nolan and his
Extreme Auto in Cumberland
Park.
So
like auto shops and things like that.
Yeah, and some of the other restaurants that have the butlers in front of them also have.
Do you have a website?
We use the Clean Gloucester Facebook page as our primary.
Is there a list there of places where people can get these things?
I believe there is, yes.
All right. You want to send us a press release?
I would love to.
All right. This is what I want from you. I want a map.
Yep.
All right. Where all the different locations are. And I want a list of where people can get the little ashtray things. All right. Is there anything else you want to add?
There are a couple cleanups coming up that we would love to have great attendance at again. The next one is hosted by the Cape Ann Trail Stewards on October 29th in Goose Cove. And then we are doing one the first weekend in November. We'll let you know when we nail down the time for it. But it's the weekend of the King Tides, which are the super, super low and super, super high tides.
Oh,
so we're going to use that low tide to our advantage to work on some areas around some of the docks in the harbor that we can.
That's great.
We'll have more accessible.
Good idea. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Good idea.
I'm trembling right now. Barn identity. I'm sorry. What was the Facebook page again?
Clean Gloucester.
Clean Gloucester. Okay. Yep. I'm gonna put. Is that what you would like me to link to?
Yes, please.
Right next to your
name.
Yep.
That's where we do all our posts about cleanups and other activities that we're working on.
Awesome, Ainsley. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Ainsley. Our next guest is none other than Gloucester's most realistic and honest historian, Ron Gilson.
There you go.
Thanks, Joey, for having me this morning. I'm happy to be here and to tell my story, at least briefly, for the hopefully the large audience on Good Morning Gloucester. Anyway,
huge audience.
About 3 years ago, I participated in a documentary on the history of the St. John's Church. I had a little snippet appearance, but I also had exposure to my friend Jim LaBelle, who put that history together, and I was so impressed. I asked him to meet me at Two Sisters one morning and discuss this project. And over coffee a couple of years ago, he agreed to help me, and I agreed to have him and so forth. Well, anyway, we worked it out, and we made this history into a two-part episode, if you will. The first part one takes the Gloucester fisheries from 1623 to 1923, roughly 300 years. The segment that I'm talking about today, part two, is really my segment, and that goes from roughly 1940 to 1955, a period of 15 years. Now, in 6 years, Gloucester will be celebrating its 400th anniversary. 400 years of commercial fishing. It's my opinion that the first 300 years, from 1623 to 1923, was a period of what I call sail and salt. By sail, I mean no motive power other than sail. And by preserving fish, we had salt. In those days, that allowed our vessels to go for 3 months on the end, or they could have gone to 5 or 6 with salt. That all changed around 1923, when in 1923, the last sailing schooner, the fishing vessel Columbia, was launched in the A.D. Story Shipyard in Essex, Mass. That was the last vessel to be equipped with sail alone and no auxiliary power. It represented a turning point in our fishery. And with the invention of the diesel engine and the refinement thereof, by 1923, we were in a pivotal position as far as changing the motive power. So we went from sail to diesel engine. Now that's an important thing, because the cenotaphs that are in front of the statue of my man at the wheel, it's about 5,000 men on those cenotaphs. And it all happened from way before 1623 up until about 1923, 1930. And there was a significant change from 1930 on. By 1940, with the invention of the refinement of the diesel engine, the dragnet method of fishing, the diesel engine allowed us to have a dragnet method of fishing, to the discovery of redfish, that all came together pretty much at once in the 30s. By 1940, the start of the era that I talk about in this video, we were on the threshold of an amazing revolution in the city of Gloucester. So in my opinion, the first 300 years were kind of like a waste of time. We did the same thing over and over and over again. We fished with hooks, we didn't change our methods, we navigated and fished with sail power, and we put men overboard that threatened their lives and so forth. As the great naval architect said, Thomas McManus, the vessels were cheap to build and the men were expendable. So for that reason alone, when the diesel engine came in and the dragnet method, the industry was revolutionized. So again, 1940, at the end of the Depression, freight yards were out. Freight yards like out here were obsolete. The salt industry was over, and the refrigeration industry came in, flash freezing by birdseye. So we had the diesel engine, the discovery of the dragnet method, and the flash freezing of fish, fresh fish, and of course the discovery of redfish. So this is the era that I'm talking about in this video. And it was a fantastic, fantastic era. It was an unbelievable era. And I'm not capable of describing how enthusiastic it was, and how it was such a robust feeling around the town in those days. It was just a phenomenal era, and it was a renaissance, if you will. Now, in my old age, I'm not lobbying for a return to the old days. By all means, I'm perfectly satisfied with where we are today, and I think Gloucester is on the threshold of another renaissance, another change. And we're adapting to it. The fishermen are adapting to it. Our fishermen, as always, are on the front line. They know what's happening long before any National Marine Fisheries port agent or anything. They're on the front line. They know. In 1965, I went to work for National Marine Fisheries. I worked there for about 6 months. And, you know, what I saw was rather disappointing. But nevertheless, this video that I've made tells the story of this 15-year period when Gloucester was the largest fishing port in the world. And when I went to grammar school in 1945 at the Central Grammar School, the textbook said Gloucester is the leading fishing port in the world. Today, we're about 26, and I think that ranks about three up from Beverly. So we're in a different era. But that's not to say that our fishing industry is over and done with. I don't believe that at all. I think what I've observed, and I have documentaries, pictures, videos of fish coming out of vessels that are far superior to the quality of fish we landed 50, 75 years ago. I grew up in the era and worked in fish plants where we spiked the brine tank, extra salt to make the fish float faster, green fillets to turn white. Okay, I grew up where we took frozen hake, took the wrappers off, and repacked it as haddock. So we did a lot of things that were injurious to the industry at the time. Today, that's not so. Today we have modern refrigeration. Vessels carry their own refrigeration. They make their own salt ice at sea. They put these fish in what they call a slush ice. They're floating in water, seawater, and seawater ice. And the product comes out absolutely beautiful. So that's where we are. We have people, young people today, that are investing in vessels. A young man that I knew, I insured, in fact, his father, and he just took delivery of a brand new vessel, Jenny and Rose, a lobster boat. His competitors call it an aircraft carrier. But this young man has seen fit to reinvest in the industry. And my friend Peter Libro, I know him personally. I knew his grandfather. And he, in the Cabaret 5, is, you know, a diversified fisherman. He's lobstering, he's mackerel fishing, he's doing this. He's finding a way. And I think, in the years to come, Gloucester's always going to be about fishing. Now, in my day, we had the United Shoe Machinery Company in Beverly, Mass. That was the largest corporation in the world, larger than General Motors. It's all gone. The shoe industry in Lynn is gone. The tannery industry in Peabody is gone. I'm here to say, and I sincerely believe this, that the fishing industry in Gloucester will always be here. Now, will it be like it was in 1945 and 50? No. It's transitioning. It's in a state of flux, a state of change. That's what it's all about. Our fisheries is about change. And where our fishermen are adjusting to this change. In my video, I talk about that. The Gloucester that I knew is not the same Gloucester that I experienced back in the 50s. But I think we're adjusting, and there's hope here. The industry will always survive, and I say that because we're always going to be surrounded by the ocean. Unlike the United Shoe Machinery Company, they could locate anywhere. Not us. We have the ocean. And as long as this ocean surrounds us, there are going to be men that are going to challenge it and rise to the occasion, and they will be in the industry.
Well, thank you, Ron. You can go see Ron's movie at on October Thursday, October 26th at the Rose Baker Senior Center. And also November 18th at the Sawyer Free Library in the at 2 p.m. in the friend room. 9:30 a.m. on Thursday the 26th is the
That's right.
Ron, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
All right.
Now, young lady.
We've had a lot of guests today, haven't we?
Yes. It's all been, each and every one's been like mind blowing.
It has been a slow period. Yeah.
What a life! Yeah, it's like a lifetime.
It's a long one. I had a couple topics I wanted to bring up. I wanted to thank Maria Saniti for. I haven't got the answer yet on how many hanger stakes. You didn't put in a thing,
I
did
saw,
you?
No.
I'm just going to see if she's responded yet. She still hasn't responded. So Maria was kind enough. I had a podcast with Alicia Cox on Thursday night. We taped an Alicia Unleashed podcast. And one of the topics was some of the super long-standing, high-operating restaurants in town, the Duckworth being one, Passports being one, and the Franklin being one. And we talked about, it's too bad that Ron just left, because we'd spoken about the transition from Eau Beaujolais,
right,
which was where Ron's old, they
right,
bought
Union Hill,
Union
we
Hill Coffee
breakfast,
Shop.
Yeah,
right?
Union Hill, yeah.
And the Eau Beaujolais, when they shut down, they reopened where the Franklin was as Cafe Beaujolais,
right,
operated for a shorter period of time. And then Maria's group, the Franklin people from the south end of Boston, opened up the Franklin Cape
Inn.
David
and Maureen, yeah.
David, who was it?
David Dubois and Maureen. Maureen.
That's with Greg Bover?
No. Maureen was in Gloucester. Her boyfriend was the tech director for Gloucester Stage.
Oh, wow.
And Peter Schmidt, and she was working in Boston, and she was in love with him, this big Dutch guy. Came out for the summer, waitressed at the Rum Line for a summer. They had all worked at the Opera Company of Boston. Our tech director, David Dubois, who was one of the founding owners of Franklin, and Maureen. And after they opened the Franklin, it was successful.
The South End,
they were like, we want to expand, where should we go? And they had both loved Gloucester from their time here with Gloucester Stage Company.
Wow.
Because I went in to sell them an ad the first time there, because I'm like, you're open late. This is a natural. Yeah. And Maureen looked at me, she goes, I know you. We've been out. And I have pictures of us at Halibut Point.
Oh, that's hilarious.
When she worked here. And they loved Gloucester, and so this is what they wanted to do. Very smart. David and Maureen were very, very smart.
I went to the Franklin in the South End in Boston before I ever went to the Franklin Cape Inn.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's open late.
Huh?
It's open late. It was one of the only restaurants
So Maria, from the beginning, they had on this hanger steak with pommes frites, and it's I don't know, everybody I talked to, if you mention the Franklin, they mention the hanger steak. You know, like I imagine like guys like me that aren't very adventurous go to the hanger steak, you know. And so I'm like, and it's been a staple there all these years. So during the podcast, I said, Jesus, if we can get a hold of Maria right now, I'd love to see, because a lot of these computer systems,
right,
you can pull up exactly how many of these of menu items,
right,
that you have sold.
Right.
And so we Facebook messaged her and says, can you, is it, if you can get that number, I'd love to run a contest on the blog saying whoever can guess the closest to the number of hanger steaks over the years. So she got back to me and says, not only can I get that number, we'll sponsor a hanger steak and two drinks to whoever guesses the closest.
Oh.
So it closed last night at midnight. The contest closed, and we have to 40 guesses.
Yeah, the guesses
are
great.
And so I'm just waiting to hear from her to announce who the winner is.
We're all wondering who that is. I could not even begin to. God.
So do you want to hear how my? I don't know. Did I write it in? I think I did. Oh yeah, I wrote in my theory was, so they opened in 99.
Okay.
So I did 17 years. By 340 days per year, because I just took out a few snow days or whatever.
Yeah.
Times 18, I did 18 hanger steaks a day was my calculation, and that's how I arrived at 104,040 steaks.
Wow.
But I think I'm probably a little high, because they may not have had the hanger steak on from the very beginning.
That's true. Yeah.
I'm not sure. I can't wait to hear my guess on further. If I thought about it a little bit more and took a couple of years off of that, it's right around 85,000, and I bet you that's where it ends.
Yeah.
If I had a double, and I'm not, my guess is
75 to, I don't know.
My guess is not relevant. I'm not a winner. I couldn't win even
if I pegged it.
But. But that's how I came up with that.
Yeah, 75 to 80. I think you have to factor in people who come from other places would probably go to seafood first, maybe.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Huh. But how many seats do you think they have there downstairs?
Well,
do you think there's 100 seats?
They just had downstairs, and then they moved the downstairs and upstairs.
But
and
say you just went based off of the downstairs, 100 seats.
Do you think it's that much?
No.
I don't know. Maybe 100. Not more than 100, though.
So say 80. And because they're open late, how many turns do you think they average there? You think they average two turns?
Oh, yeah.
160. So 160, you divide. So
I go 18. In late and I see tables turn over when I go in late.
Right. That's what I'm saying. So if they average two, say it's 80, so, 80 seats.
Say half of them are.
And say there's two turns, that's 160. And so 20 into 160. Is I don't know. I'm probably high.
Wow.
We're gonna find out though when she gives me the answer. So there's that. I have to address this topic, and it's too bad that it's at the very end of this podcast, because it's something that in my household that I think is hilarious. So we have this crow issue at our house.
Do
you have crows where you are?
Yes, we do.
Do you consider it a crow problem?
No.
Okay. Where do you live?
I live right near Good Harbor Beach, so right near Bass Rocks Golf Club.
Any trees close to your house?
We have trees, but I have not noticed a crow problem. We have quite a hefty squirrel population. I have a squirrel who sleeps on my front step very often.
Okay, but they don't make the racket that crows make.
No.
Our neighborhood, East Gloucester, like High Popples Road to coming from where Twin Light Manor is to the Grapevine Road, there are probably 30, 40 crows, and we have we're surrounded by trees. So I'm usually not there at dawn, because I'm out of the house by quarter of four. But the Saturday mornings I'm off, and Saturday mornings as soon as day breaks, the crows are going bananas, literally outside of our bedroom window. And it wouldn't matter on what any side of the house you would not escape the cackling of these crows. And I haven't talked to any of my neighbors about it because I just haven't. I'd like to speak to the Parsons girl, Kristen Parsons. She's a teacher at East Coast School.
Eliana is one of my superstars. Eliana,
yeah. And she was at the play yesterday. Yes, I saw her at the play.
Yep.
So I'd like to speak to her to see if they drive her as nuts. Yeah. So they don't. So I got home. This is one afternoon last week. And Kate was sitting on the couch, and she was staring straight ahead, and her eyes were kind of twitching. And I could see that she was unnerved. And you know, I was just kind of sitting there. And said, maybe she's having her period. Maybe she just have maybe it's not her period, but like pre what do you call that? PMS.
PMS. Carefully there.
Or maybe she had. Or maybe she just hasn't a lot of sleep. Maybe she's stressed out about something else. But I could see there was something going on right here. Right, like her eyes her mind. And, you know, we got to, so, you know, I'm like, oh, you want me to take you out for dinner or something? She's like, okay, let's get, you know, we'll go. She goes, and so then I'm like, she goes, the fucking crows are driving me crazy. This is after I've been home for about 45 minutes. She says, the fucking crows are driving me crazy. I want to murder all of them. And she goes, I've been researching it all day long. And I'm like, oh, you know, now that you mention it, yeah, they are cackling. So it's at night, it's just at dawn and dusk, they seem to be the worst. So I'm like, now that you mention it, yeah, they are probably pretty loud right now, right? But like, the whole time I was home, I didn't notice them once.
Until some.
It's a no.